with a dog and man make a boat for the water. My Bible said Noah made the ark. This is a man's world.
Ow! James Brown first recorded that in 1966, a time of madmen, the year that Betty Friedan founded the National Organization of Women, 3 years after the feminine mystique. Today, 46 years later, women are dominating almost every aspect of society, work, education, culture, and personal lives. How did we get here, and what does it mean for our future? In a way, it's been the perfect storm. The changing nature of work, the move from an industrial to an information-based economy, a different set of skills that are required. All of these things have certainly played a part, but something else is at play. The social revolution of the 60s, the civil rights movement, Title IX, the repeated failures around the world of patriarchy, all have played a role. Have we really reached the end of 200,000 years of human history, or is this simply a mid-course correction on the road to greater gender equality and the full flourishing of both sexes? We're going to talk about all of this today with a guest whose book is garnering national attention and certainly conversation everywhere. She is Hannah Rosen. She's a senior editor at The Atlantic. She is the founder of Slate's Double X and the author of the new book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women. Hannah Rosen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. This is not a manifesto in any way. This is really a series of observations about what's taking place in our culture and our workplace today.
I'm so glad you described it that way. In fact, it's true. I mean, it's not really a feminist manifesto, only because a lot of the changes I describe are not all that positive. So some of the women who I interview in the book, for example, don't want to find themselves in a position where they are the main breadwinners of the family. It's kind of an accident of history where, for various reasons, the jobs that are available are ones that they can more easily do or that they can go to school and get the credentials to do. But it's not always a positive development.
In many ways, if we look historically, we see lots of times in which the culture shaped economic aspects of the society. In many ways, this is a reflection of the economy shaping the culture in a profound way.
Exactly. I mean, I talk about women's flexibility in the book and this idea of the plastic woman and the cardboard man, sort of women adapting more easily. But if you look at other times in history, like after World War II, you see that, you know, that's when the GI Bill was passed and you see men coming back from war, them maybe feeling like they had to quickly establish themselves, flooding into colleges, you know, taking over farms, working in offices. So that was a point when men were extremely adaptable and flexible to whatever the economy was throwing their way. I think now it has to do with the end of the manufacturing economy and then its replacement with a service and information economy in which men don't have a natural advantage and which women may have, in fact, some advantages.
And yet we saw men be flexible during that period after World War II. What happened? What changed as far as men are concerned?
I think it's that, first of all, I mean, at a very basic level, it used to be very possible if you were a man who didn't want to go to college, get a college degree, and you wanted just to earn money, to do that and have a very prosperous middle-class existence. So that's the case of a lot of men I write about in a town in Alabama, where they lived, you know, a very nice lives, actually, with houses on the lake and nice cars. And then when those manufacturers left, you know, maybe they did construction, but then there was the housing crisis, and so that went away. And so that left a lot of middle-class couples in the lurch. And because a lot of the jobs available in America, for example, in the healthcare industry or to some extent in government or teaching, you saw women who took over roles that they hadn't really played before. And some of this is a cascade effect where as more women enter the workforce at the top, they open up jobs lower down for of things that women used to do for free. So childcare, elder care, service industry, food preparation, also jobs that tend to be female-dominated. And a big part of the story is college, frankly. We happen to live in a moment, for better or worse, where a college degree is required for so many jobs that it didn't used to be, and women seem to get college degrees more easily than men. I'm not sure why. You know, nobody ever said women were smarter. They don't test smarter than men. It's some other quality focus. You know, maybe it starts early in school, but for whatever reason, for every 3 degrees that women get, men only earn 2, and I think that makes life quite a bit more difficult if you don't have a college degree in the U.S.
I want to talk about this idea that it started a while ago, that this isn't entirely reactive to economic conditions, but it's also in many ways a function of the efforts that were made 15, 20 years ago to really focus attention on girls and on their success in many ways, which led them to their success in college.
That's absolutely true. I mean, one thing I think about is the alchemy of this period is women having these opening job opportunities and coming off an era in which we really pushed our girls to succeed, yet at the same time feeling a sense of injustice, like they don't get paid as much as men and, you know, there's still not enough women at the top. And that combination has almost pushed women forward to behave like immigrants. I mean, that's how I describe a lot of the women in my book. For example, a woman who goes through pharmacy school while her boyfriend sort of gets left behind. And, you know, my own parents are immigrants, and her spirit reminded me so much of theirs, like her need to really push ahead and feel like she had to work twice as hard. And, you know, and then there was this great opportunity for her to go to pharmacy school where you can earn a really good living when you graduate from pharmacy school. And that's one of the professions that is getting taken over by women. So it's this moment in history where the different factors, you know, it's like a perfect storm, basically, pushing women forward.
And as you said, there's also this sense that men had an attitude of entitlement.
Yeah, I mean, that you know, that maybe sound insulting to some men. Sometimes it's not an attitude of entitlement. It's just they had a path laid out for them, and then when that path was taken away, I can see this very strongly in the men I write about in my Alabama chapter. Mm-hmm. They weren't quite sure what to do. It's hard to remake yourself. It's hard to just, you know, start again. For women, it's kind of fun, even if they don't want to do it. They're suddenly earning a paycheck for the first time, and even if they're starting at the bottom, they can look forward to be promoted. Whereas for men, to ask them, you know, to go from a situation in which their fathers and their fathers' fathers had a steady job someplace, which they quite loved, you know, which was very fulfilling and really a big part of their identity, to suddenly hustle in this new economy and try and, you know, work their way in and start at the bottom, it's kind of asking a lot of someone. So I think that's why it doesn't work. Whereas you see in World War II, it did kind of work because they were coming off from a war period, and so they were in that hustling mode, whereas now they're not so much.
The other thing that's interesting is the degree to which this is happening in one way or another throughout the world. This isn't something confined, and I want to talk a little bit about the class issue later, but this isn't something confined to the U.S. This is happening in India, in China, even in South Korea.
Yeah, it's happening in very different ways. So I think if you look at the global numbers in India and China, you'll say, oh, they still have a one-child policy and there's a lot more boys born. But I picked South Korea as an example because that's an extremely patriarchal society and still very patriarchal. And yet, you see these amazing shifts happening. Women entering the workforce, entering colleges at huge rates. They, too, have surpassed men in graduation rates in South Korea very recently. And it's a very test education-driven society. So they're kind of at a moment of crisis where the women are racing ahead and the society really doesn't know how to accept that or incorporate that into its culture. And so the people I talk to are, you know, they're really hard trying to figure this out. I mean, we bend a little bit to these cultural changes, but they're really having a hard time knowing how to incorporate these newly ambitious women into their cultural landscape.
And one of the things we've seen dramatically here is that while the same phenomenon has been happening, it's been happening in very different ways with respect to class in this country.
Yes, I purposely divided the book into two different class analyses because, like everything else in America, the marriages, which is what my two chapters are about, is utterly divided. You have completely opposite trends going on in marriage because of the rise of women. So in the college-educated class, we have the most happy, stable marriages that we've had in a long time with the lowest divorce rates, and I think that's largely because nobody's trapped as the breadwinner or the homemaker, that these gender roles have become more fluid among the college educated, and they have what I call seesaw marriages, which means that anyone can take the breadwinner role at any moment. So the Obamas have one, for example, mm-hmm. where Michelle Obama was working as a healthcare executive for many years and supporting Barack Obama while he was in school and while he was doing his political career, and now he's the president. And, you know, she's supporting him as the first lady. And so they switch back and forth, which is very common to college couples these days. But for the non-college educated, you really have a disintegration of marriage. Far fewer people getting married, many more children born to single mothers, many fewer fathers sticking around. And so it's really quite opposite in how it's unfolding.
And women in the lower classes are looking at men as, to quote one of the women, another mouth to feed.
Yes, and it's so, I know, I can hear your male listeners kind of, you know, booing as they hear that phrase, but I'm telling you, the number of times I heard that exact sentence from women, you know, why would I marry him? He's just another mouth to feed. I know how that sounds and how insulting it is. I'm just saying, I heard that so many times as I was trying to figure out, you know, why aren't people getting married? Wouldn't this woman's life be so much easier if she was married to the husband of her children? It's actually the way I started this research, is by meeting such a couple and really puzzling over why they were getting married and trying to get them back together. I tell the story in the introduction, and she just, you know, to him, he was more of a burden, you know, until he kind of got his act together and got a job. She felt like she would just have to support him, like he would just be another child in her house, and so it didn't seem worth it to him, as insulting as that scenario sounds.
The new ball and chain.
Yes, the new ball and chain is something I heard from college students. Again, sometimes I bristle when I say these things, but, you know, it was so different talking to these college women than when I was in college, where we just largely assumed we would have equal marriages. You know, we'd both work and we'd both take care of the kids. And in fact, the women at this college that I visited in Kansas City largely described their husbands as dependents, almost, you know, as people that they would have to hustle and take care of for a long time.
In many ways, this divide in class is as a result of these economic changes and the hollowing out of the middle class.
Yes, very much so. And that's where I say that this isn't a triumphalist manifesto. I mean, there's a lot of, when you read some of the stories in the book, what you see is that people are struggling. I mean, we know this because we've been through a series of recessions, but it's not making anybody any richer to have one-parent families and to have children raised in those families and to have men out of work. So the hopeful part of this is, you know, ideas we can have about a dignified exit for men who are in the manufacturing economy. And some of the characters that I write about actually do work in new forms of, say, high-tech manufacturing, where, you know, you need some kind of education. It's like meeting the new economy halfway, the technological changes. You know, you sort of get to up to speed with certain technological changes that allow you to have a really pretty good job at a high-tech, say, aeronautics plant or something like that. And so that's a way of, you know, preserving jobs that men find, you know, preserve their identity of being manly and macho, but are still thriving in this economy.
And yet in community colleges, we see the enrollment being about 70% women.
It is really startling. I mean, if you think of community colleges as the kinds of places where people are learning practical skills for first-level jobs in the economy, entry-level jobs, you do see a lot more women than men. Now, there are, like, engineering colleges that are obviously an exception to this, but in your average community college, you have vastly more women than men. And I describe, there's an image that endures with me as the image of a woman who falls asleep in the elevator in a community college I visited between the first and the eighth floor, only because she was raising children, going to school, and holding down a job. And, you know, as you can imagine, that would exhaust anyone.
Among these women, particularly in Alabama, that don't look favorably upon marriage, that don't look favorably upon many of the men in their lives, how do they view their sons? How are they raising their sons?
They do look favorably upon marriage. That's the thing. I mean, in lots of conservative places, people actually have an ideal about marriage that sometimes the men around them aren't meeting. That's the problem. I mean, these are fairly Christian culture where people believe that the man should be the head of the household and should behave in a different way. So they have a pretty fixed notion of what marriage should look like. It's just that their reality doesn't meet up to that. And the thing about the sons, another thing that's not that positive, I talk about a rising matriarchy, because essentially what happens is, you know, we've all heard of the phenomenon of investing in your son. I mean, that's something that we've done historically. If you had money in the 50s, you would send if you had money for just one child to go to college, it would be your son. Even if your daughter was the smarter one, that's just how we thought about it, because the man would obviously have the better job. And what a series of researchers noticed lately is that in working class families, particularly if a father is not present, they end up investing in their daughters. If they have only enough to send one child, they send their daughters to college because they have the sense that their daughters will succeed more in school. And so this creates a kind of entrenched culture of, you know, women kind of going to college even more so, and men not as much. And so we don't want that. I mean, we sort of want to put a halt to that, I think.
And what it will lead to is a culture of more unemployed young men in those communities.
Yeah, I think that's a real tragedy. I mean, that's a larger economic issue. There's a part of me when I visit these towns that thinks, why can't we just put the factory back in the town, you know? That would really be the answer here. You know, why did we ship all those factories overseas? I realize that's unsophisticated and doesn't take into account, you know, a lot large global trends, but, you know, my emotions run in that direction. You know, we traded away all these men's jobs and identities and sense of purpose so that we could have, you know, towels that were 20 cents cheaper or something. You know, it just didn't, it doesn't seem to me like a fair trade for our country. But, you know, that's those forces are much larger than my emotions. So,
coming back to the woman that was falling asleep in the elevator at the community college, one of the things that we're seeing is that as women move into these new roles, they don't necessarily give up any of the old roles.
Yes, this is a phenomenon I noted. I think I described women as an expanding colonial empire. That I had this insight when I was doing my large survey, which about 8,000 people answered about breadwinner wives, you know, the women who make more money than their husbands. And almost always I would find that the women did not give up old spheres as they took on new spheres. So, and this shows up in statistics about American time use as well, how Americans spend their time, that even when women are working a lot more hours, making a lot more money, they still feel they should control the domestic sphere, sometimes to the great frustration of their husbands, but it just seems to be the way it works. So one couple I described has, you know, they have decided together that he should be home taking care of the children while she goes to law school because she's very successful at law school, and yet when she comes home, you can see clearly that the domestic realm immediately reverts to her control. And I think that's not uncommon. I mean, I describe myself in that situation. There was a time my husband took the kids on vacation so I could finish a chapter of this book, actually, and the script running through my head, if I were to be honest, was, you know, he's doing this wrong, he's packing wrong, he's taking the wrong things for the kids. Now, because I was writing the book, I kept my mouth shut because I know that's not productive and I should really entirely be grateful. But that is a dynamic that seems to take hold.
In addition to the class divide, there's certainly a generational divide. What are we seeing among the younger generations in places like Alabama, particularly as the younger women move on to college?
So there was a big divide generationally there, and I think it's because the older couples, even if they found themselves in this mixed up upside down position, had many years of, you know, biblical teaching and a certain way of living that ordered their world, and so they would fit the new reality into the old order. So they definitely felt that their husbands were still the head of the household, even if they weren't the breadwinner. And, you know, they were pretty stable because they'd lived a certain way pretty happily for so many years. But in the younger generation, even though they had grown up in the church culture, you could see that their economic reality was so at odds, and frankly their educational reality in terms of who from the high school ends up going to elite prestigious colleges. You know, it seemed that the girls were having so much of an easier time that it just isn't a nice picture. I mean, as you see, I go down the generations in my chapter, you see a woman really struggling with the father of her child and her soon-to-be second child, you know, really struggling to convince him, look, that factory life that you've been dreaming about, it's a phantom. It's never going to come back. And, you know, trying to force that reality onto him so he figures something else out and does something else.
To what extent is it resulting in a lot of anger among men?
I think there is quite a bit of anger, and you can imagine I even feel it when I talk about these things. They've had an unfair hand dealt to them. I mean, I don't think you can tell men you have to behave in this way that doesn't come naturally to you. You know, you absolutely have to go to school. They've actually tried to set up programs, say post NAFTA, to help men go through school, and it doesn't sit well with a lot of men. They feel like they should be earning money, you know, not spending their time studying. And so I think it is not a fair position to find yourself in. The only thing I could say is the positive place when I think about, I have two sons and a daughter, and when I think about my sons, you know, the place that I hope for is to ease the pressure on some of these things. So often when men are unemployed and come to my events, what I say to them is, you know, I understand you're unemployed, but don't put the extra burden on yourself of saying I'm unemployed and therefore I'm less of a man because I'm unemployed. You know, the tragedy of your unemployment is the same as the tragedy of a woman's unemployment. You know, you don't have to put that extra burden on yourself. And so if my own sons should find themselves in a situation where they are dating or engaged to or married to a woman who makes more money than they do, for example, I want to get to the point where that's no big deal. I mean, where that's perfectly okay. And I think that's reasonable and not and should not be emasculating.
There's a quote from Gloria Steinem that sort of goes to the heart of that. She says, and this is from 20, 25 years ago, that we've begun to raise our daughters more like sons. Do we have the courage to raise our sons more like daughters?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's harder. I mean, it's not an equal trait. I mean, it's one kind of surprising thing when you do research on men and women is you realize there is a way in which men live in a kind of smaller box than women do, that both the expectations men place on themselves and that women place on men are heavier burdens in some ways. And maybe there's something natural to that. I tend to resist explanations that say, you know, that come from nature and not nurture, but there may be some way in which, you know, we look to each other for things that we can't really get, that are very hard to change culturally.
Except that the argument against that is when we look at the more educated communities, when we look at the upper class and we see the way men in that group are changing and have adapted to change, it's an argument against the issue that it's just hardwired, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I am with you. I really don't like the hardwired argument because, like I said, you know, you can look at the man next to you and say, like, he's a really flexible guy, and look at the woman and say, she's so rigid. It's not about personalities or the way we're constructed, because you see that, you know, like I said, after World War II, men were very flexible. It looks more like an accident of history. And you also, you know, for example, you look at other countries like Eastern Europe and Asia, and you see that, you know, there's a lot more women doing engineering and science. You know, here we have the sense that men are somehow hardwired to do those things. But if you look at cultures where those things are, you know, broadly encouraged and promoted for everyone to do, a lot more women do them. So you feel like even if we can't completely switch places, there's further we can go down that continuum of women and men behaving in different ways.
And talk about how women are embracing this. And the extent to which it is positive or, for some of them, even negative.
So women are all over the map. I mean, in some senses, this is just straightforwardly positive for women to have more opportunities in this economy, to be able to do a broader range of jobs. You know, even there's something empowering for some women in being able to support their own families. There's fewer sexual abuse. That's something I write about, too. When women are less dependent on men and not trapped in marriages and more abusive marriages, that's a theory of criminologists about why there's been a decline in abuse over the last, especially 10 years, but more like 15, 20 years. So there are some definitely positive developments. And then the negative developments, as I say, is a lot of people are nostalgic for the old way, and they feel like there's a lot more pressure on women to do everything. So they're still doing the domestic realm. They're still supposed to work really hard. They're basically supposed to do everything at full speed, and that's just exhausting. So I don't write about this that much in the book, but if you look at happiness studies of women in the 70s and women now, women do not measure more happy than they were in the 70s, and I think it's largely because of these different pressures that they have to face.
And for younger women, it relates to another subject you've written about that's gotten a great deal of attention, which is how women have dealt with the hookup culture today in colleges.
Yes, I do write about the hookup culture, and I do write about the way in which we largely portray women as victims of the hookup culture, and I think that's only one part of the story. While I think if you talk to any woman in college, you'll get a huge number of complaints about men and how they don't commit, you will also get a picture of a very different set of ambitions and expectations for women. So the fact that men don't commit plays a smaller part in their lives. Really, what they're largely thinking of is their future, what they're going to do after college, how they're going to establish themselves. And as a lot of women say to me, you know, like the worst thing, if in the 19th century the worst thing that could happen is that you would get pregnant and you weren't married, now the thing they think of as the worst thing that can happen is you have an overly eager suitor who's trying to tie you down too quickly before you've had a chance to really establish yourself. And so the danger, of course, is that, you know, women never get married, but that doesn't seem to be happening. That doesn't seem to be showing up in the statistics. It seems to be right now that American women, at least, are going through, you know, 10 years, sometimes a little bit more, of, you know, having relationships, establishing their careers, and then eventually they get married in their late 20s or early 30s.
Ultimately, like so many other things in our society today, will this make us just more polarized?
You know, I really have no stake, because I called my book The End of Men. It's sort of like a grenade in the gender war. So really, I have no authority here. But in truth, the positive message to come out of this is, as I said, to relax the gender roles around men, to relax the pressure on them, to not have them take on the extra burden of feeling less manly for staying at home with their children or choosing to become a nurse or a teacher. Like, if those things were all fine when my sons were that age, I would be delighted. And for women, I think to shed light on what a big role women are playing in this economy and how little the workforce is acknowledging that. So how little we acknowledge things like childcare or, you know, maternity leave and all the basic things that are not in place in the American workforce, despite the fact that women are such a huge part of it these days.
And I suppose the thing that, and you mention a few of these examples in the book, the thing that we have to constantly watch for is the way that this all gets portrayed in popular culture, because that's an indicator.
Yes, I mean, popular culture is an popular culture, if you think of it as our subconscious, you know, it doesn't have a political agenda for the most part. It just throws new prototypes at us, and in some ways they're positive, and in some ways they're just puzzling. So for men, the positive ones is you are, for the first time, starting to see men who play a big role in the domestic sphere and are not idiots or bumbling or doltish the way domesticated dads have been throughout, say, the history of the sitcom. So there's a show called Up All Night, an NBC show in which there's a very respectable, even sexy stay-at-home dad, you know, and that's a big development in American television, or What to Expect When You're Expecting. That movie had a bunch of stay-at-home dads who were very cool and fun and funny, and at the same time, on the women's end, you're getting this puzzling phenomenon of quite violent, you know, Katniss Everdeen from The Hunger Games, very popular heroine of the last couple of years, is basically like a man. I mean, she's aggressive, she's violent, she's the provider, she's the protector, she kills, you know, for her cause. And she's quite unpleasant, you know, whereas PETA, the man, behaves more in the way we typically think of as a woman behaving. He's collaborative, he wins over crowds, he smiles, and he's a romantic. And so you see that pop culture is throwing prototypes at us, different and new ones, and just sort of seeing how we'll take them in.
Hannah Rosin, the book is The End of Men and the Rise of Women, just out from Riverhead. Hannah, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Sure, thank you. That was delightful.
You.